istituzioni economiche e che sono le istituzioni politiche a determinare come funziona il sistema del processo economico. In particolare nel capitolo 13, che non a caso è intitolato Institutions, per ricordare a tutti qual è, diciamo, il tema centrale, si espone la tesi di fondo che i paesi che hanno successo hanno istituzioni inclusive, che consentono e promuovono il pluralismo, in cui il potere non è concentrato, è contenibile e in cui l'innovazione è sempre possibile. I paesi che falliscono, poi vedremo che cosa significa falliscono, hanno istituzioni invece estrattive, che consentono a piccoli gruppi appunto di estrarre a proprio vantaggio dal paese la maggior parte delle risorse, e in questi paesi si ostacola anche l'innovazione. Quindi ci sono paesi con istituzioni estrattive, per esempio la Cina, che hanno tassi di crescita significativi, ma ci dicono Robinson e Asimoglu, questa crescita non sarà stabile, perché queste istituzioni, le istituzioni estrattive, non garantiscono la stabilità nel tempo. Un tema, come immaginate, molto interessante per l'Europa e forse anche per l'Italia, in cui le istituzioni estrattive, diciamo, molti di noi hanno avuto esperienza, ma la mia presentazione si ferma qui.
I can't sit and talk, so I'd rather stand there actually, but perhaps that's not very practical. So I have this. Can I stand there?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I used to stay above the desk, so you can also stay in front of the desk. They are trained to all the possible divisions.
So if I talk, I tend to talk loudly. Is that everyone can hear me if I talk standing? And I think I'd much rather if I stand behind that, I'm going to feel very inhibited. So let me stand here. It's much easier for me to do. So okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk. Thank you very much for that. A very generous introduction. I don't know any Italian, but I know Spanish, so I can get about 50%. And thank you very much for the invitation. I'm delighted to be here in Rome and talking here at Rome 3. I've never actually done anything academic in Rome before, so I'm very happy to be here, such a distinguished audience, and especially with lots of lawyers and legal professors and law students who should be very susceptible to the idea that the kind of humanly devised institutions are, you know, what separates rich and poor countries and economically successful and economically unsuccessful societies. So the book, so I'm going to give a little overview of the book, that's my plan, and then you can ask questions. So the book is, you know, is proposing a simple framework for talking about comparative economic development. Why is it that some societies are economically successful and other societies are not economically successful? Both sort of today, meaning, you know, looking around the world today and trying to kind of distill some key differences between poor and rich countries, and also sort of historically. So the book is very kind of historical. It's trying to explain, you know, why the world ended up looking the way it did. Why is Italy, you know, poorer than Canada, and, you know, and why is Italy much richer than Algeria or Sierra Leone or Cambodia or the Philippines? How did it end up that way? How did all this wealth and prosperity end up getting concentrated in, you know, Europe or Northern Europe or North America or Australasia, and not in Southeast Asia or Sub-Saharan Africa or Latin America? So to understand that, you have to understand the kind of historical patterns of the emergence of this enormous inequality and this huge divergence in economic performance in the modern world, at least over the last 250 years. So I'm going to kind of introduce all the ideas and kind of all the moving parts of the explanation we have in the book. I'm going to start by telling you a story about the comparative economic and political history of the Americas. That's sort of chapter one of the book. So I'll tell you a little story about the Americas, and the history of the Americas, and which will sort of propose an explanation for why there's so much inequality in the Americas. Why is the United States and Canada so much more economically successful than Mexico or Argentina or Colombia or Haiti or whatever? But before I get into that, let me just say a few things. I already started talking about rich countries and poor countries. You know, obviously the world's much more complicated than that. You can't just sort every country into one or two bins, you know, poor countries and rich countries. So I'm going to do that a lot in this talk, just because it helps to develop the argument, to sort of think about this dichotomy between successful countries and unsuccessful countries. So, of course, in reality, there's lots of nuance and grey areas, and that's all interesting. And if I was, you know, doing a statistical paper or doing some more academic analysis, I'd allow for much more fine variation between different societies and how they're organised and all sorts of stuff. But for the purposes of getting the argument going, it's very helpful just to think in terms of this dichotomy, successful, unsuccessful. Okay. The second thing I want to observe before I start talking about the history of the Americas as a way of developing the ideas in the book is to sort of say, you know, since the 1950s, since the research of Robert Solow, for which he won the Nobel Prize in economics, economists have sort of known that what drives long-run economic growth is what Solow called total factor productivity. So Solow was looking at the economic history of the United States and asking, you know, over the long run, what is it that drives economic growth? Is it capital accumulation? You know, so Ricardo and Marx and 19th century economists thought this was all about capital accumulation, kind of getting machines and building up more machines and tools and factories. And what Solow showed was that actually, you know, it wasn't the accumulation of factors of production. It was change in the sort of the efficiency with which factors of production are used. So that sounds very nerdy, but let me give you a very specific example of that, which is the first industrial revolution. The first industrial revolution, which started in the 18th century, that was really the event that sort of started modern economic growth and started the kind of this amazing divergence throughout the world, because if you go back to 1750, there were very small differences in income per capita or even technology between different parts of the world. These huge differences we see today are a consequence of something that happened after 1750. So, and that started with the Industrial Revolution. What was the Industrial Revolution? The Industrial Revolution was exactly about kind of improving the productivity of factors of production. Of course, there was capital accumulation going on, but the real story was innovation. It was the mechanization of cotton spinning and cotton weaving. It was the factory system, new ways of organizing production. Steam engine, new sources of power. The train, you know, new sources of transportation. So it was all about new ideas, innovation, new ways of doing things, new ways of labor saving, raising human productivity, generating new goods, better goods, more goods from the same amounts of inputs of human labor and capital. So Solow pointed out that was really crucial, you know, if you thought about the long-run economic growth of the United States. And we know that the same thing is true if you look across the country today. Of course, it's true, you know, that if I look at a poor country like Sierra Leone in West Africa, then, you know, people are much less educated and much less healthy than the average person is in Italy. So you could say human capital is much lower in Sierra Leone. But it turns out that the main difference in terms of generating differences in prosperity is the same thing Solow was looking at. It's differences in total factor productivity. It's not so much differences in people and their embodied skills and knowledge. Yeah, sure, that's certainly true. But the bigger problem is the stuff that people have to work with, the kind of the absence of technologies and methods of raising productivity that we're so used to in Italy or in other countries. Okay, so I'm emphasizing that at the start because I'm going to come back to it. It's very important for thinking about what type of society is likely to generate that kind of economic growth based on total factor productivity and innovation and creativity and things like that. Okay, so let me start now by talking about the Americas, and let me go back, you know, 1500 years to the time of the discovery or the conquest of the Americas, you know, what one of my Colombian friends calls the Great Invasion. So So the great invasion of the Americas by the Spanish and the Portuguese and the English and the Dutch and whoever it was. I don't think the Italians got in on that actually. No. So you know, just the reason one. The Americas is sort of interesting is because now we know kind of the patterns of prosperity in the Americas. We know where the prosperity is and we know where the poverty is. That spans, you know, almost the entire spectrum of inequality in the world. You know, because Haiti has a level of income per capita which is similar to a sub-Saharan African country. And at the top, you have the United States and Canada, and you have more or less everything in between. So, but what's interesting about that is if you go back at the time of the conquest, it would actually have been very difficult to predict. And Europeans who were involved in this, and even far after, completely failed to predict which parts of the Americas were or were not going to be prosperous. In fact, at the time of the conquest, the parts of the Americas that were prosperous were the places in Central America, the Central Valley of Mexico, Andean Peru, and Bolivia. These were the places with large, complex society, technology, writing. The Incas built 25,000 miles of roads. They had famine relief. They had a postal service. You know, well, the postal service was only really for the Inca, you know, the king. But that was how the English postal system was like when it was set up in the early 17th century too. So the Incas got there before the English did. They had a system of runners, they had public good provision, they had taxation, they moved huge amounts of goods around, and you know, so this was, you know, what was there in the United States? Nothing. You don't have any kind of society on that level in terms of technology or organization, provision of public goods, taxes, etc. So, and in fact, that's exactly, you know, actually what you see at the time of the conquest is that everybody thought that the action and the interest was in Central America, Mexico, Andean, Peru, Bolivia. You know, the English ended up colonizing the United States, not because anyone thought it was an attractive place economically to colonize, but it was everything left by the time the English got their act together. They took Jamaica off the Spanish, they tried to take Cuba, but they were too late. The only thing left was the United States. You know, no one wanted it. The Spanish didn't care about it. They had a bit of Florida. So why was that? You know, why was that? And why is it significant? Well, let me go back to the colonization of the Americas. So one could tell lots of stories, but the story we tell in the first chapter is the colonization of Argentina, Buenos Aires. So that's a fun story, because when the Spanish first came, they got excited. They found some silver. They called it the Rio de la Plata. You know, silver. Okay, great. Now we're in business. So they started, they founded Buenos Aires. Turned out the silver came from way to the west from the Inca Empire. There was no silver around there. There were very few indigenous people. There were the hunters, some hunters and gatherers, very sparsely populated. They started looking for silver. They sent out expeditions. They discovered up the Paraná River in what's now Paraguay, the Guarani. So the Guarani was a very different type of society from the society in the Pampa. The Guarani were very dense population, high population density, agricultural society with hierarchy and kings. The Spanish abandoned Buenos Aires en masse. They moved up. They had to be refounded later. They moved up the river and they took over the Guarani. Okay, and if you look at what happens at this instant, you see everything about the future of Latin America. I always think I'll have to support that with some evidence in a minute. But so what they do when they take over the Guarani is they start structuring this colonial society. And you know, I'm going to use the word institutions. By institutions, I'm going to mean the sort of rules that humans create to structure, you know, life, economic life, political life, social life. And I know there's lots of lawyers here, so let me emphasize that I don't just mean stuff that's written down, you know. I mean also what Douglas North called what sort of formal institutions. There's also a lot of informal institutions that are going to be important. So, for example, an informal institution that became deeply embedded in colonial Latin America, which is still deeply embedded in Latin American society, is an expression which is called, the Spanish expression is obedezco pero no cumplo. I obey, but I do not comply. You know, so this, for example, is an attitude of many people towards the law in Latin America, in my experience. There's a sort of, I obey, you know, but I do not comply. So there's a sort of, you know, there's a social norm not to obey the law, you know, which is activated in some contexts. I can talk about that. So, including by lawyers themselves. So, So let me just be clear, and I can give some examples of that, even from the United States, and that's just as true in the United States as it is in Latin America. After all, you know, where did this two-term limit for the U.S. presidency come from? Not because somebody wrote it into the Constitution in Philadelphia, but because George Washington set a precedent, set a social norm that no one should be president more than twice, and that stuck 150 years until Franklin Roosevelt took advantage of the Depression and the First and the Second World War to kind of violate that. So, informal institutions are just as important in the United States as in Latin America. It's just that, often they're less functional in Latin America. Okay, so what are these institutions that got set up in Asunción, in Paraguay, the capital of Paraguay? Well, first thing, indigenous people were divided up amongst the conquistadors as what's called grants and encomienda. So the labor market, if you were an economist, you could talk about labor market institutions. The labor market was organized by sort of dividing indigenous people between conquistadors. This was conquistadors were in it for loot and profit, and the more money you put in, conquistadors, you signed a contract. If you put money in, you brought horses, you paid for a ship, some oars or some sails, whatever it is. The more money you put in, the bigger share of loot you got. They wrote a contract. So you put more wealth in, you got loot. And what was the loot? Indigenous people. You were granted these indigenous people in encomienda in exchange for what? In exchange for tribute, working for you, etc. So the labor market was organized around encomienda, attaching indigenous people to Spaniards, around systems of forced labor, monopolies, monopoly of trade, monopoly of production, monopoly of exchange. It was even a system of forced purchase of goods. So there was it was a very coercively organized society. The conquistadors kind of set up a system to transfer wealth from indigenous people to themselves. Okay, what happened in North, and this model was reproduced all over South America, in Mexico, in Colombia, in Peru, wherever. So what happened in North America? Okay, well, the English, let me talk about the colonization of the United States by the English. 1607, Jamestown colony, three boats showed up. The Virginia Company formed a little settlement on what was called the James River, after King James I. What about the Virginia Company? What was the Virginia Company? You're thinking, well, these were English people, right? So they had the common law, they had liberty, they had constitutional rule. Well, not quite in 1607. That sort of came later on, maybe after the Glorious Revolution. So, well, they had the common law. That was around in 1607, right? They had, tea and cucumber sandwiches, irony, all those wonderful British things. Actually, the Virginia Company was out to make money, just the same as any group of conquistadors. They wanted to make money. They were investing in money in the whole enterprise. And they came with a plan. And here was their plan. Their plan was completely based on how the Spanish had colonized South America. And the plan says, number one, capture the local indigenous leader. If you look at all the conquistadors, what they did was they would capture the local indigenous leader, Atahualpa, the Inca. They captured Montezuma and Tenochtitlan in the Central Valley of Mexico. Once you captured the indigenous leader, then you used him to control indigenous society. Atahualpa famously delivered one room full of gold and two rooms full of silver after he'd been captured in Cajamarca by the Spanish. So you gained this leverage over indigenous society, and then indigenous people started working for you. You could start exploiting for them. Okay, so this was the model the British had. So first thing, find out who the local indigenous leader is. So it turned out there was a local indigenous king. It was called Juan Sunacoc. But Juan Sunacoc was a very different person from the king of the Guarani, or King Bacatao, or Atahualpa, or Montezuma, or one of these other people. He was ruling over a very kind of unstable coalition of small tribes, very unhierarchical, very uncentralized, nothing like the Inca Empire or the Mexicas or the Guarani or the Chichas and Muiscas in Colombia. It was a very different type of society. He was very suspicious, also, of these people who'd shown up in Jamestown. They invited him to Jamestown. They had a plan to capture him. He refused to come. They said, yeah, you can come to my place if you like, but I'm not coming to Jamestown. You might wonder how he spoke English. He didn't speak English. Previously, they'd captured some indigenous people and taken them back to England, and they taught them to speak English. So that was how they translated. Anyway, so there was a there was this. They couldn't figure out how to do this. It was a bit like when the Spanish came to Buenos Aires and they discovered there were no indigenous people to exploit and there was no silver, this was sort of what Virginia was like, except Virginia didn't have the Guarani up the river. So they were stuck with this environment. So the second winter in Jamestown, two-thirds of the colonists starved to death. They starved to death because they didn't bother planting any food. Because that's not how you colonized in the Americas. You didn't work and plant food and farm in the Americas. You exploited the indigenous people. So they starved to death, you know. The second year came. Well, what's happening? The Virginia Company was not making any money, that's for sure. So they thought, okay, fine. Forget this business of exploiting the indigenous people. It's not going to work. Let's exploit the English people. So at this time, there were about 300 English people in Jamestown. So they put them in these barracks. They said, okay, no, now you have to start working. Forget this indigenous, forget the Indians. Start working, you know, and we're going to make profit by exploiting the English people. And they sent a new governor and they passed some new laws. And the first law said, any settler who goes and lives with the Indians is punishable by death. That's an odd kind of law. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, you know, but if I'm, you know, it seems odd. You should have, like, wouldn't the first law be something like, you know, thou shalt not kill, or it would be setting the wages for lawyers or something, or like, you know, I don't know. Why would you have that? Well, of course, as soon as they tried to exploit the English people, they just ran away into the forest. You know, this was not, you know, the Virginia Company, they had a little fort and stuff. They couldn't control anything. People just didn't, the English people just ran away. So that model of exploiting the English didn't work either. There were other reasons for that. You know, for example, one thing is, you know, there were very few English people there. The Virginia Company decided, we can't make a functioning colony with just 300 people. We need to get more people to come. So they wanted to get more people to come. So if you want to get more people to come, it's very hard to do that if you're viciously exploiting the people who are there already. So in 1618, the Virginia Company did something really radical. They did the following thing. They basically gave up on the exploitation model. So they tried to exploit indigenous people, that didn't work. They tried to exploit the English people, that didn't work either. So they went to the third plan, which was, let's give them incentives. They freed everybody from their labor contracts. Most of these people were indentured laborers. They gave everyone 50 acres of land. So at this point, the Virginia Company was sort of maintaining the fiction that it more or less owned the entire western United States, however big that was, they weren't quite sure. So they were, you know, so they gave everyone 50 acres of land. Anyone you could bring, relative, friend, servant, got 50 acres of land. So they created a situation where they gave people incentives and opportunities instead of trying to exploit them. Well, you know, what did the Virginia Company get out of that? Well, the Virginia Company still owned all this land, so they thought, you know, if we can make this place prosperous, that's going to drive the value of the land up. We're going to make a lot of money, and let's try doing it like that. And in 1619, they did something even more radical. They created a legislative assembly to basically they gave away political power in the colony and sort of said, okay, you get to control the settlers, the colonists got to control these institutions they were working under as a way of making the whole thing kind of believable or credible. Okay? So what I claim is that, what we claim in the book, is that this early organization of Latin America versus North America is fundamental importance for understanding the subsequent development of those places. In Latin America, you know, you had a very hierarchical society, very unequal, emerged based on the organization, regimentation, exploitation of indigenous labor, barriers to trade, barriers to opportunity, barriers to incentive, labor coercion. In North America, a very different society, colonial society, emerged based on creating incentives and opportunities with a very different structure of political power as well. Now, let's back up and talk about two things. One is nuance, and the other is how on earth can something which happened so far in the past be relevant for understanding, you know, the world today? So, first, nuance. You're thinking to yourself, gosh, you know, didn't they have slavery in the United States? What about, you know, what about 12 years? I just went to see 12 years a slave. Wasn't that in the United States, in Paraguay? Sure, it was in the United States. And, you know, this is where nuance is important. You know, sure, the U.S. South was a slave economy. It was much poorer than the rest of the United States. It had very little urbanization, very little manufacturing industry, much lower density of infrastructure. So the United States was poor, much relatively poor. The slave South was poor and backward. But the crucial thing is that the slave economy developed much later than these early institutions that I'm talking about. So one of the reasons why the US slave economy was much richer than other slave economies was that it had the good fortune to be embedded in this larger national set of institutions, which were very functional compared to the institutions in Brazil or Peru or, you know, elsewhere in the world. So that's, you know, the slave economy, yes, it was poor, it was backward, but it was, you know, that's something that takes off after this process of institution building that I'm talking about. So that's very important to bear in mind. What about the historicalness of this thing? You know, so well, what we try to do in the first chapter is we try to say, you know, from these initial conditions create very different types of societies. And in a minute, I'm going to kind of abstract from that and sort of back up and introduce some terminology, which hopefully is, you know, has some generalizability to talk about what were the essential differences between these two societies. But the idea, what we try to show empirically in the first chapter through lots of different examples, is that, you know, once these societies got set in place, there were enormous forces that lead them to reproduce themselves over time. Okay? And we end in the first chapter by talking about, you know, the two richest men, you know, in the world, Bill Gates and Carlos Slim. So, you know, those men are both very clever, intelligent, energetic, whatever. But they made their money in very, very different ways. And the different ways they made their money says enormous amount, I think, about the difference between North America and South America. Bill Gates made his money through innovation. Okay? Sure, he wanted to be a monopolist. Everyone wants to be a monopolist. You know, university professors want to be intellectual monopolists. It's just a natural human, you know, impulse. If you read Adam Smith has this great famous passage, you get a few businessmen in a room, they come up with a plan to defraud the public. You know, it's just how human beings are. Carlos Slim made his money not through innovation, but through monopolies, creating monopolies. You know, I work a lot in Colombia, in South America. If you make a list of the 30 richest people in Colombia, every single one made their money from monopoly in banks, monopoly in cement, monopoly in beer, monopoly in glass, monopoly in soft drinks, you name it. You know. So that's the way you make money in South America. It's not the way you make money in the United States. It's been temporarily true, and I'm happy to come back to this question of what's going on today in the United States with rising inequality and how should we interpret that. That's usually a question people are very interested in. But I think the big picture here is that, looking historically, the United States has been a place with much lower levels of inequality than any Latin American, than in any Latin American country. And it's been a place where the way to make money was to innovate and, you know, and not to create monopolies, okay, with some exceptions that I'm happy to talk about. So let me give you one. So there's Bill Gates and Carlos. So here we have, like, you know, the Asuncion and Jamestown. And in between that, there's a few hundred years, and then there's Bill Gates and Carlos Slim, and you're wondering, well, what could be, you know, in the middle in between these two things? And let me give you one brief example, because once I've got this brief example in place, I have, like, all the moving parts of the theory. And the example, you know, which I like a lot, because I actually did real research on it, you know, is 19th century frontier expansion. So, there's a quaint myth. I don't know if any of you have spent, you know, time in the United States. But, you know, the United States is a very sort of parochial place. You know, so people like to study, you know, in political science. I don't know how this is organized in Italy. I'm sure it's organized differently. But in the United States, political science is organized in the following way. There's something called American politics, which is not really about America. It's about the United States. But it's the politics of the United States. It's called American politics. And then there's something called comparative politics. And comparative politics studies the politics of every country in the world except the United States. And in comparative politics, you're not allowed to compare anywhere to the United States. And in American politics, you never compare the United States to anywhere else in the world. So one of the consequences of that intellectual organization of political science, it's quite similar in history as well, is that you can get very parochial ideas circulating. And one of them is this so-called frontier myth. So Frederick Jackson Turner, who was a Harvard historian, wrote a book in the 1890s about how the reason the United States you know, continually think they're exceptional. The United States are always thinking they're exceptional because we don't study anywhere else. It's easy to think you're exceptional. there's an academic industry endlessly coming up with new hypotheses about why the United States is exceptional. So Jackson Turner's spin on this was that it's to do with the frontier, Western expansion into the frontier. The Western expansion into the frontier, this vast open spaces, creates this very upwardly mobile, democratic society, kind of pioneering, innovative, you know, prosperous, etc. Now, that would be great, except for the fact that, you know, almost every Latin American country had a frontier in the 19th century as well. Guatemala had a frontier, Mexico had a frontier, Chile had a frontier, Colombia had a frontier, Argentina had a frontier, everywhere had a frontier, except maybe El Salvador or Haiti. So if frontier expansion is so good, how come there isn't a democratic frontier myth in Chile or Guatemala? You know, and the reason is that the way the frontier was allocated was completely different in almost all Latin American cases. In the United States, going from the 18th century right the way up to 1862 with the Homestead Act, the frontier was opened for sort of homesteading. So you could go out, well, not if you were a slave, that's that nuance again. You could go out if you were a white person, and you could file title. You could put a fence up, you could claim 60 acres of land, the government would give you a certificate, and you might have stolen that land from some indigenous people, but the government would give you a certificate. So the importance about that is not that indigenous people, I'm not claiming indigenous people did well in the United States, they didn't. They didn't do well at all. But the point was, you couldn't create a society in the United States based on the exploitation of indigenous people like you could in Peru or Ecuador or Bolivia or Colombia or Mexico or Guatemala or El Salvador. So the Homestead Act opened up the frontier in this very egalitarian manner. In Latin American countries, what you've got was extremely oligarchic frontier expansion. If you look in Chile, for example, in Chile finished at the Biobío River, which is sort of halfway down the Central Valley in Chile today, in the middle of the 19th century. South of the Biobío were Mapuche, Araucanian Indians. So, thanks to the Winchester repeating rifle, the Chilean state expanded south of the Biobío in the second half of the 19th century. All this land got opened up. What happened to it? It was auctioned off in huge lots to politically connected elites in Santiago. Okay? Totally different from the Homestead Act. Now, first question, how come there was a Homestead Act in the United States and not in Chile? Well, that has everything to do with the very different nature of political institutions. So right at the start, I mentioned this General Assembly in Jamestown, 1619. That's the start of a very democratic kind of impulse in United States society. Okay? It wasn't the constitution that created democracy in the United States. That went way back into the colonial period. Okay? So the reason that something like the Homestead Act got passed was because at the time all white males could vote. Okay? This is not perfect democracy by modern standards, but by the middle of the 19th century this is a very egalitarian distribution of political power. So the egalitarian distribution of political power, which went all the way back to the early colonial period, forced open the frontier. So it distributed assets in a very equal way, and that tended to reinforce the political circumstances that gave rise to it. So this is an example of what we call in the book the virtuous circle. Okay? So there's a politics generates a wealth distribution that tends to reinforce the initial political situation. Okay? And I want to emphasize something else about the politics of this that I'll come back to. It's not just that political power was so broadly distributed that, you know, you couldn't have an oligarchized frontier expansion like you had in Chile, but the state was capable of enforcing and protecting your title, giving you a title and enforcing it. Okay? In fact, there's two Latin American countries that passed laws which were similar. One is Costa Rica and the other is Colombia. In the Colombian case, you know, the state was completely incapable. So they passed laws in the liberals passed laws in the 1870s and 1880s, which were similar in form and spirit to the Homestead Act. But the Colombian state was completely incapable of providing anyone with a title or would enforce it if they do. So those two things are very important. So in Chile, you had a very oligarchic political system. You had a narrow distribution of power. You got a narrow, an unequal distribution of assets in the frontier. And that tends to reinforce, again, the different political circumstances that gave rise to it. Okay? So I'm sort of trying to get you to see there that this early colonial society triggers very different dynamics over time both in terms of the politics and the economics, and that's crucial leading all the way up to Bill Gates and Carlos Slim. Okay, so let me back up now and make some sort of generalizations, still staying with this dichotomy. So in the book, you know, the kind of the first part of the book, the main, you know, the first idea in the book is to say, okay, what generates economic development? Well, it's creating a set of institutions in society that create incentives and opportunities for people. Okay, and we say a set of economic institutions that creates incentives and opportunities, we call those inclusive economic institutions. Okay, so why inclusive? Well, that word really comes from the work of a great economic historian, Ken Sokolov. So Ken studied patenting in the 19th century. So when the United States became the world's most innovative country in the 19th century, people like Thomas Edison, you know, he invented the light bulb. What did he do when he invented the light bulb? He took out he paid a fee and took out a patent. Okay, to protect his intellectual property rights. Well, the point of patents is to create incentives for innovation. So what Ken did was, Ken studied the social background of patentees. And what he showed is that something very, very interesting. It's exactly the same thing is true about the Industrial Revolution. There's a book by the French economic historian François Cluzet about this. But what he showed is that if you look at patentees, people who took out patents, they gave them all over the social spectrum, rich people, poor people, elites, non-elites, artisans, farmers, you know, even literate, uneducated people. This is not a plea for, of course, the United States was highly educated in the 19th century compared to anywhere else in the Americas, so this is not a plea for illiteracy. But as a matter of fact, you know, uneducated people have ideas too. And so he showed that, you know, and he showed that, in a, you know, kind of, that there was this immense latent potential in society, you know, ideas, creativity, entrepreneurship, you know, that's very broadly distributed in society. So if you want to have an innovative, dynamic economy, you've got to set up a set of institutions that harnesses all that latent talent in society. You don't know where it is or who has it. You have to let people come to the top. And that's what inclusion is about, and that's what the patent system. The patent system was open to everybody on the same terms. Everyone got the same protection. This wasn't some, you know, you have to be a friend of someone, you know, if you want to get a patent and get your patent protected. That's, you know, it was available on the same terms to everybody, and it was a very inclusive, so that's an example of what I'm calling an inclusive economic institution. Okay, so what did the Spanish have? Well, what did they create in Latin America? Extractive economic institutions. We call those extractive economic institutions. Institutions that get in the way of incentives and opportunities. And this is not, let me emphasize, about the Spanish. You know, think about South Africa. My favorite example of an extractive society is white apartheid South Africa before 1994. That was a society created by the English. Well, with also help from the Dutch as well. But the English, you know, that was not created by the Spanish or the Portuguese or the Belgian. It was created by the English, and it has a level of inequality which is very similar to a Latin American country. And that's not very surprising, because South Africa was designed to exploit black people and Africans for the benefit of a small white European majority. Okay, so extractive and inclusive economic institutions. So one way of talking about the book is to say, you know, the book tries to explain that if you look around the world today, countries that are rich tend to have inclusive economic institutions, countries that are poor tend to have extractive economic institutions. If you want to explain how all this inequality emerged in the modern and early modern period, then you have to understand how some societies made a transition from extractive to inclusive economic institutions, and how that generated more rapid rates of economic growth. And in fact, all of this inequality you see in the world today, in some sense, was generated by the process set in motion by the British Industrial Revolution, by the emergence of inclusive economic institutions in Britain, by the emergence of this much more rapid technological change and economic growth, and by the very uneven dissemination of all of that to different parts of the world. You know, what created that uneven dissemination? The institutional map at the time. If you think about the time the Industrial Revolution started in the late 18th century, the United States had developed very different economic institutions than Latin America. By 1820s, you know, this modern manufactured technology, factories, all of this, railways started spreading like mad to the eastern United States. not to Latin America. That has everything to do with their institutions at the time. But that's the kind of boring part of the book. The more interesting part of the book is, you know, I just told you a story about divergence in economic institutions, and, you know, I told it in a case that you're going to think is kind of, maybe it's a bit idiosyncratic. He's coming up with some theory of, like, colonialism, and so how do I think about Italy? Was that a colony? I suppose it was. The Normans invaded the south of Italy, but didn't the Normans invade Britain, and that didn't do so badly? So, you know, what's the story here? The story is, and the right abstraction is to say, you know, is that economic institutions are crucial for economic performance, but they're an outcome of a political system. So they're collectively chosen through the political system. So I'll go back to my example of the Homestead Act and the difference between frontier expansion in North America and South America. I told a story about economic institutions, but what was driving that variation was the different politics of North and South America. It was the fact that in North America, you had this broader distribution of political power in society, you had this more effective state. And in Latin America, you didn't have that. So in some sense, the kind of more novel part of the book is to say, well, what lies behind these different sets of extractive and inclusive economic institutions are sets of political institutions. And that's really the emphasis of the book, from politics to economics. And in fact, we emphasize, you know, if you want to have inclusive economic institutions like the Frontier Act, you need to have inclusive political institutions. And that's made up of two things, both of which I illustrated in that argument. One is broad distribution of political power, and the other thing is an effective centralized state. Okay? And when any of those things fail, we say you have extractive political institutions. Okay? So now, you know, going back to this vicious circle and virtuous circle and poor countries and rich countries, you know, you could think of a kind of little matrix with four cells. Poor countries have extractive political institutions, you know, leading to extractive economic institutions and poverty. Rich countries have inclusive political institutions creating inclusive economic institutions and prosperity. Okay? So if you wanted to ask, you know, historically, how did some countries like Britain or like Italy or like get from extractive to inclusive, we need to think about politics more than economics. Okay, so embedded in this story about Latin America and North America I'm claiming is a much more general story about politics. It's a very kind, you can say it's a very idiosyncratic political context in which inclusive politics and inclusive economics emerge in colonial Virginia. It's a more normal story in Latin America. But of course there's many sources of variation in the world. There's many paths to different inclusive institutions. Let me tell you a little bit about the British path. I won't talk too long probably. Let me tell you a little bit about the British path, and then because if something comes out which is maybe not so obvious at some so far. So you know, and you know, this is very much thinking about, you know, how Britain went from being extractive to inclusive and how the Industrial Revolution came. That bears some lessons for thinking about, you know, how do we solve the problem of development today? You know, so how do we make Sierra Leone into a rich, or Nepal, or, you know, into a rich country, or Guatemala? Well, the theory says you've got to make it extractive institutions inclusive. Okay. Well, how do you do that? Well, that's difficult, and it's difficult because there's lots of conflict over institutions. Okay, because institutions, economic institutions, are the outcome of a political process, there's often large, you know, conflicts of interest over them. After all, you know, colonial Latin American society, you know, the organization of extractive institutions in colonial Latin America, that might have created poverty, but it created a vast amount of wealth for the people who benefited from those institutions. You know, that was even true about Spain and England. You know, if you ask who did better out of their colonies, the Spanish or the English, the Spanish did. The Spanish got vast amounts of wealth as the Americans. The British didn't get anything. In fact, when we tried to tax the ungrateful Americans, they declared independence. You know. So it's very important to think about the distributional impact of these institutions. So because, you know, extractive institutions get set up because of their distributional consequences, there's bound to be conflict over institutions. And in fact, the story about the emergence of more inclusive political and economic institutions in Britain in the 17th century is exactly a story about conflict. It's a story about the English Civil War in the 1640s and the Glorious Revolution of 1688. It was two civil wars that created a more inclusive political society in both senses, both in the terms of a broader distribution of power and in terms of a stronger central state. So it was conflict that created that transition. So in the book we emphasise a lot, you know, how do you move from extractive to inclusive? That's a very conflictual process. Think about the Arab Spring. You know, think about how people in Egypt, you know, or Tunisia, they were very upset and unhappy about President Mubarak's dictatorship or President Ben Ali's dictatorship. They tried to organise collectively to overthrow those regimes. Okay, so that's very much in the spirit, you know, of what we're talking about in the book. But then if you know something about Latin American history, you might be thinking, well, but hold on a second. You know, he started off with this story about there's a vicious circle and a virtuous circle, and once society gets set up in a particular way, there's enormous kind of tendency for it to stay like that. But Latin America is full of revolutions and conflict. You know, I work a lot in Colombia, as I was saying. Colombia's had a civil war going on, you know, since at least 1964, and depending on how you count it, probably since the late 1940s, there have been revolutions, civil wars all over Latin America. So how come that hasn't led to something inclusive? You know, what we emphasize in the book, and this is like the last thing I'll talk about before I shut up, is, well, that's right, but it's only some sorts of conflicts that lead from extractive to inclusive institutions. So what we talk about there, and this is a very kind of empirical thing, actually, which is based on a lot of work by historians about the nature of the Glorious Revolution, and really it's about the emergence of the rule of law in late 17th century and early 18th century England, is that we emphasise, you know, when you tend to see kind of transition from extractive to inclusive institutions, it comes because of a particular type of conflict. And we have this concept of the broad coalition, that what matters is who's in conflict with who. So let me give you a very tangible example, since you're all lawyers here, which involves the law. So the Glorious Revolution, this conflict in England in 1688, James II was the king. The Glorious Revolution kicked him out of power. Okay? So James II created lots of grievances in England. And one thing he did was he liked to intervene in legal cases. So some judge made a decision he didn't like. He'd fire the judge and, you know, put a new judge in. So this eventually led to it led to taking politics, comes a bit later in the Act of Settlement in the early 18th century. But this led to a kind of much more autonomous judicial system, this reaction against all this political intervention in the judiciary. So James II was always intervening in these legal cases, and this was a big source of grievance at the time. So if you look at, you know, if you look at contemporary accounts of the grievances, you know, people were very upset about this. So imagine, you know, we're in a room here, we're in some coffee house in London, we're all upset about, you know, James II doing this, and I'm trying to, you know, foment rebellion. And I'm trying to say, you know, James II, he's intervening in legal cases, and, you know, this isn't good, and, you know, we should get together, get some guns, get organized, overthrow him, you know, and then we'll be in power. And when we're in power, we'll get the legal decisions we like, you know, he'll be out and his guys, but we'll be in and we can get, you know, Andrea, you want a decision, no problem. You know. So now that's, you know, that could work. But that's a version of, you know, what we call in the book the iron law of oligarchy. You know, that many revolutions, you know, basically just replace one elite with another elite on top of a basically extractive society. So this is, you know, I feel good talking about this in Italy, because this is actually Pareto and Mosca, the two great Italian sociologists who basically created these ideas in the late 19th century. Sort of anti-Marxist, saying, you know, Marx had this idea that society progressed, feudalism, capitalism, socialism, and the Italian sociologists came along and said, that's all nonsense. You know, basically, there's always some elite at the top exploiting everybody else, but you have this process of elite circulation. So I think that's a very important kind of model to have in mind when thinking about conflict and the impact of conflict on institutions. So most Latin American revolutions, you know, are something like elite circulation, rather than a transformation in the way things are done in society. So what's different about the Glorious Revolution? Well, let me go back to the coffee shop and me offering Andrea a favourable legal verdict. The point is that somehow the more and more of us who are involved in this the more difficult this model is. You know, so I could offer Andrea a favourable verdict if we're in power, or I could offer Luisa a favourable verdict, or, you know, but what happens if these two are in conflict with each other? Well, I can't offer them both a favourable verdict. You know, so somehow the more people are involved in this, the more you can't give favours to everybody. You know, favours only works if you're a clique. You know, you can't give favours to everybody. So the idea we have in the book is that if you have a very broad coalition involved in this, and what you see at the time of the Bourgeois Revolution is that, you know, everyone gets against James II. Parliament, different sides of Parliament, the Whigs and the Tories, the two kind of nascent political parties, you have merchants, landowners, farmers, everybody is sort of against James II. James II has an army, so, you know, he has some cards, but there's a broad upsurge in society against him. And somehow you can't motivate this coalition by offering individualized favors. So what emerges out of this is something like, you know, the rule of law or a level playing field. You know, well, we can't all get favors, but here's what we could do. You know, let's have a level playing field. Let's have a rule that applies to everybody. And, you know, and that's going to be different from and better than what James II is offering. So the idea in the book, and we don't present a theory in the book, something we're working on kind of empirically now, is about, you know, under what circumstances do you tend to have this broad coalition? I'd say, you know, that has something to do clearly with the structure of society, with the diversity of the economy, with different things like that, which is something we have looked at in kind of early modern Europe. But in the book, we don't really talk about that too much. We just sort of say it's this particular type of conflict with a broad coalition trying to foment institutional reform that tends to create this transition from extractive to inclusive institutions. So let me, I think I probably said enough. So let me shut up and see if you can ask questions.
Thank you.
Marcello?